I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. The first 9 months of this year have been the hottest on record for the United States. Large parts of the country face serious drought and wildfires in 2012. Arctic sea ice melt has been increasing over the years and sea levels have been rising. And this week, Hurricane Sandy has devastated large swaths of the eastern seaboard. You would think that with all these extreme weather events, questions about climate change would have come up in the presidential campaign this year, but it didn't. So we asked Brian Walsh to join us. He's senior editor for Time International. He writes the Going Green column for Time and Time.com, and he contributes to Time.com's environmental issues blog, Ecocentric. And Brian Walsh, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Going back to previous elections, to 2004, 2008, and before then, did the words climate change ever get uttered at any of those debates?
Yes, I mean, climate change was at least discussed, or there was a climate change question in either the presidential or vice presidential debates going all the way back to 1988. This was the first year since then when, in none of the four debates, was climate change even mentioned. And maybe some of the moderators said that they were going to, but didn't get around to it. But it sort of underscores where the issue had fallen in terms of interest for the campaigns.
And why do you think it's fallen so far?
Well, I mean, it's a lot of things. I think, for one, you know, clearly this campaign was very much focused on really one issue, on the economy, and that was by far the biggest thing everyone was talking about, whether it was the deficit, whether it was dealing with unemployment, whether it was dealing with the future with Social Security. So that sort of prompted this campaign. It seems to be a lot more one issue than most. There was a little bit about foreign policy. So I think that reflected really where the campaigns were looking to make their mark, but also, you know, I think it also looked at where the public is looking at. I mean, we've seen since 2008, when climate change was, I think, a pretty important issue in the campaign then, we've been dealing with a major economic downturn, and that tends to focus people's attention on the here and now, what will happen to me tomorrow, not necessarily what will happen to me in 10, 20, 30, 50 years. And so I think that leads to a kind of policy myopia that the campaign certainly pick up on. They don't really feel, I think, that outside the environmental community, there are people, voters out there screaming for more attention being paid to climate change, at least maybe not until recently. So that's the campaign simply reflected that.
But do you think Sandy has and will change that conversation? Of course, less than a week until the election.
Yeah, well, I certainly think it's already changed the discussion. I think you saw Bill Clinton at a campaign event yesterday talking about climate change and Hurricane Sandy, and actually President Obama did mention it to an MTV reporter last week before Sandy. Certainly, this is the kind of event we know. Back in 2005, it was Hurricane Katrina that really focused attention on climate change. I think you led from that to Al Gore's movie, and really that was sort of the peak of interest in that issue. So it tends to be, we tend to be a disaster-driven public when it comes to these kind of issues, whether it's the oil spill, whether it's something like this. So when suddenly you see New York City, large parts of New York City being flooded out, hundreds of thousands, millions of people losing power, you see a storm that's so unusual, so rare and so freak hitting such a large part of the country, it becomes impossible to avoid thinking about, is there something changing in the weather? Is there something that's actually making this happen more often? And does that mean this is going to be something we're going to have to deal with even more in the future?
Is there settled science and consensus among researchers that climate change is real and it's here?
Yes, I mean, that is absolutely true. There is settled consensus when it comes to researchers that climate change is happening, and by that I mean the planet is clearly warming. We can see that. That's definitely happening. And there is consensus among scientists that man-made causes essentially are really driving the bulk of that warming. And when I say that, I mean carbon emissions that come from the burning of coal, oil, natural gas, other fossil fuels that come from deforestation. So we know that's happening. That's settled fact. The larger questions then become, well, what does this actually mean? How
right.
fast will the climate warm? What kind of effects will we see? You know, will we see more storms? Will we see more extreme weather? Will we see more droughts like we experienced this summer, really a record-breaking drought? What will this mean for wildlife? What will it mean for the environment? And that we sort of have different levels of consensus, different levels of agreement on those. It gets more complicated the further out you look, and certain weather events are harder to trace to climate change. But we certainly know enough to be very concerned, and we certainly know enough to understand that dealing with climate change, and that includes both adapting to its effects but also looking to reduce carbon emissions over the long term, really has to be an important part of any plan for the future, essentially. Like, if we're going to deal with things like the deficit, we also need to deal with this huge natural problem that's sort of facing us as well.
And I do want to get to where the candidates have stood on these issues, but I wonder whether looking at sea ice melt in the Arctic, whether that's a measurable change and that's something that people can actually agree on because you can see the numbers.
That's certainly a measurable change, and it's a very striking change. I think, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, we saw Arctic summer sea ice. Now, that's the sort of sea ice cap over the top of what is the North Pole, and it shrinks every summer, and then it grows again in the winter. We saw it shrink to its smallest extent on the satellite record, which goes back to about 1979, this past summer. Chances are that means it's probably smaller than it's been in quite a lot longer than that, and that's really a reflection of nothing more than warming. I mean, that's what's causing that. And we see the Arctic is where climate change is happening faster than anywhere else. The Arctic is warming at a faster rate than any other spot on the planet, and you see that ice changing. And it is very worrying. I mean, right now it's already changed things in the fact that we have oil companies going to the sort of north shore of Alaska looking to drill in places that would have been impossible to get to before. We may actually have ships going through that Northwest Passage just because it's clear now with the lack of ice. But that's a sign we're actually changing the planet in a way we can all see and all track. And that may actually have other additional effects on the weather that scientists are just beginning to understand. It's a little hard to catch up to this because it's really happening considerably faster than they thought it would actually.
And how many inches has it risen?
The sea level has risen, I believe, several inches going over the last century, which doesn't sound like a whole lot. But we saw with Hurricane Sandy how big a difference sort of a higher sea level can mean. Often I think people hear sea level rise and they assume almost as if the seas will actually rise like Waterworld and swamp all the cities sort of gradually over time. That's not really the issue here. What happens is if you get higher sea level rises, when you get, say, a storm like Sandy strikes a coastal area, that primes that sea essentially to be higher up, and then when you get that surge coming like we saw earlier this week, you get much more devastating flooding than you would have gotten otherwise. And so suddenly you have New York City facing floods, I believe, that exceeded 13 feet, well beyond anything the city had ever experienced before. And it's definitely true that climate change caused sea level rise contributed to that, sort of turbocharged a storm that would have been devastating, I think, even in the absence of climate change, but certainly add that, it makes it that much worse. And then when you think, well, sea level could rise more than a foot, more, perhaps even greater over the next century, that sort of indicates to us that events like this, major coastal flooding, incredibly damaging coastal flooding, like we saw with Sandy, could become all the more common.
So if you had a chance to ask one of the candidates at one of the debates a question about climate change, Brian, what would you ask them?
Well, I would have asked first, do you agree with the scientific consensus that man-made climate change is real and is a threat to the planet? And then I would ask them, what is your plan to deal with it? Do you look, and there are any number of options to this, and you could look to do what President Obama had tried earlier in his term, that idea of cap and trade, where you actually establish a legal limit on carbon emissions, and then you sort of allow companies to trade emissions credits to get to a reduced emissions path. Or maybe other people say you should put a tax on carbon, just a solid symbol number, again, that would encourage companies to look for cleaner alternatives, again, reduce carbon emissions over time. Other people say, well, maybe we just sort of support renewable energy. That's the way to help that compete against fossil fuels. Again, you reduce carbon emissions. I just would like to see that these candidates have a clear plan, and perhaps more importantly, that they think it's important and it's worth spending government resources on it. And that's something I'd want them to really to put it out there and say that they're actually going to do.
Now, looking at Governor Romney as candidate Romney, where does he stand on climate change, and does he believe it's human-made?
Well, he's put out statements that indicates that he does believe that there's warming, and he believes that man-made causes are part of it, and that he believes something we may have to deal with. But he certainly, he hasn't put forward a very strong plan or very specific plan to do that. He's spoken out against things like cap and trade and other sort of actual policy objectives that sort of been put on the table to deal with this. So it doesn't seem as if he has. It certainly doesn't think it's very important. It doesn't seem as if he thinks he has a very specific plan to deal with it. And, he's also talked in speeches almost in using climate change kind of as a punchline. He mentioned, I think, it might have been in his nomination speech that, President Obama, when he was elected 4 years ago, talked about, reducing the sea level rise and things like that. And it was a joke line for his audience. And I think we've seen a huge partisan split when it comes to belief in climate change over the last 4 years or so. among Democrats and to a lesser extent independents, you still see very high belief levels. But among conservatives and Republicans, you've really seen that dip. And so I think, you know, Romney is reflecting that. As governor of Massachusetts initially, he seemed convinced it was happening. He acted to put the state into a regional carbon reduction pact, but then later on, as he was looking forward to actually running for president, he kind of stepped away from that. So he's really, a reflection of his party, I think, more than anything else.
I'm quoting here from the New York Times. I hope you don't mind that, Brian.
Oh, no problem.
But this is talking about Romney has opposed Mr. Obama's steps to regulate emissions from power plants and vehicles. He said he would reverse Mr. Obama's air quality regulations, would renegotiate the auto efficiency standard of 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025 that the automakers agreed to this year. Just to put some specifics on the table, that there are, at least on this issue, some real differences between the candidates.
Oh, absolutely. I think this is one issue that there's actually a very great difference between the candidates. You mentioned just a number of things that President Obama has actually done that relate to climate change during his four years in office. The increase in auto efficiency will make a big difference in terms of the amount of oil the United States is going to be using. And sort of this almost backdoor way of dealing with climate change has been sort of using the Clean Air Act to actually regulate coal plants, regulate essentially carbon emissions in the future, using a regulatory tool as opposed to sort of a legal cap limit, which had been the sort of preferred idea. But because that Congress has made that impossible, that's something Obama's EPA has been trying to do. Not something Obama likes to talk about, I think, in part because he knows it's not always the most popular move. But that's certainly something that, if you saw Governor Romney elected, would almost certainly come to a stop. There's almost no way that a Romney EPA would be following these kind of policies.
But the idea of using a backdoor as opposed to speaking more overtly about whether it's extreme weather or energy issues or even climate change. It's interesting that the word climate change has is that sort of third rail of politics.
It's true. It's really has become that way, and there's been a lot of work looking to try to figure out why is this? Because it wasn't the case just 4 years ago. I mean, Senator McCain, when he was running as the Republican candidate, had no problem talking about climate change, had a plan to deal with climate change, maybe not as strong as Senator Obama's at the time, but he clearly believed it was happening. Now suddenly that's not something you're allowed to say, and I think, again, it comes back to the economy. Anything that can be seen as limiting economic growth, as complicating the economic recovery, and certainly, you know, if you're going to try to really reduce carbon emissions, you may exact a short-term economic penalty. That's just the case. We depend on carbon emissions. We depend on carbon and fossil fuels too much to not sacrifice something if we're trying to reduce that very quickly. So that's one reason why you've seen President Obama not talk about it, I think, as much. He doesn't see it as a winning issue for independents, especially maybe for those more conservative voters he might be trying to get. And he also just, you know, doesn't want to send that signal out that he's acting in any way to slow or do anything that might slow economic growth.
And, Brian, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking about some of the issues that are not being talked about on the campaign trail. In this portion of Radio Times Climate Change, Brian Walsh, senior editor for Time International. We want to know what you think. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Greener Partners supports WHYY and announces their second annual World's Greatest Farmer Showdown Sunday, November 4th, noon to 4 p.m. at Longview Center for Agriculture in Collegeville, featuring farm-based activities for adults and children, including fun with alpacas for the kids, lost arts workshops, and a book signing by author Marissa McClellan of Food in Jars, plus food, craft beer, and musical entertainment. More information at greenerpartners.org/showdown.
Sure, shouting angry pundits can be entertaining, but when they run out of breath, ask yourself this. Did you actually learn something new, or just get the same old spin? Trust Election 2012 on WHYY for the real story, not the spin. Each day, our team of journalists is out there finding the stories that showcase every perspective, not just one slanted side. WHYY-FM, newsworks.org, and WHYY-TV, where you go to know.
A century ago, Leopold Stokowski stepped onto the podium. Now the Philadelphia Orchestra celebrates the Stokowski legacy. Emmanuel Cravine conducts Stokowski's arrangement of Bach's Toccata and Fugue, plus Franck's Symphony in D minor. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. November 8th, 9th, and 10th at the Kimmel Center, The Stokowski Legacy with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. What would you have liked the presidential candidates to say about climate change and energy? Give us a call. And extreme weather, we can throw that in as well. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about some of the neglected issues this campaign season. Brian Walsh, our guest senior editor for Time International, writes the Going Green column for Time and Time.com, and he contributes to Time.com's environmental issues blog called Ecocentric. Brian, let me ask you a little about some of the things that did come up in the debate related to climate change and having to do with energy. Asked about the Keystone Pipeline, both of the candidates, both Romney and Obama, supporting natural gas. There was talk about clean coal. So certainly energy was on the table, but energy has its environmental impacts.
That's true. I mean, it was very interesting to see energy become such a big part of the debate and really of the campaign. And that's a reflection of how fast the energy situation in the United States has changed in just 4 years. You talked about natural gas and shale gas has been a huge game changer when it comes to energy. And it's had sort of unexpected consequences. We know perhaps about the environmental consequences, the concerns, but the Pennsylvanians definitely know about water contamination, other issues that may be associated with fracking and the need perhaps for regulation, but also the shift to natural gas and shift away from coal has actually reduced U.S. carbon emissions. It's been one of the most successful short-term, actually, even if it's an accidental policy, in terms of helping to reduce U.S. carbon emissions. And you talk about something like Keystone. You've seen the U.S. oil production go up significantly. The U.S. is poised in the future, I think, to actually pass Saudi Arabia and overall petroleum production here at home, and that's a big difference. And that's also really makes it harder, I think, for renewable energy and really for any anti-carbon sort of policy or technology to gain a foothold, because suddenly you see fossil fuels here in the United States, domestic fossil fuels and with domestic U.S. workers coming back, and neither President Obama nor Governor Romney can really stand in the way of that.
And that's because of jobs and the economy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's been a big part of jobs, a big part of the economy. You know, at a time when the economy has not been great, obviously, that's been actually a very bright spot for some states here in the United States.
And going back to the Keystone Pipeline, which is on hold, at least temporarily, that's connected to tar sands and Canada. What should we know about the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, it's a very interesting situation here. The Keystone Pipeline would enable Canadian oil sands crude to come to the United States in much larger numbers. And oil sands crude is particularly polluting. It's also particularly carbon heavy, in part because you need to actually use a lot of energy to get it. So there's a lot of concern among environmentalists that if you build this pipeline, you kind of put essentially the U.S. on oil sands, you encourage the development of that oil sands, you can end up adding a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. Now, President Obama did slow the project down or pause the project, but it's very interesting that he hasn't really talked about climate change as a reason for that. Instead, he's talked about some of the local concerns people have who are in the path of the pipeline, some issues of spills, but he hasn't actually said that carbon emissions are a part of it. I think that puts him in an uncomfortable position, because if you aren't concerned about climate change, if you aren't concerned about carbon emissions, then I don't really... there's not much point really in standing in the way of this pipeline. You know, it's a supply of oil from a friendly neighbor rather than from the Middle East. Certainly it's something that the Republicans have been hitting President Obama very hard on, and you can definitely expect that should Governor Romney win, we will see almost certainly that pipeline being built.
Let me see what Richard from Westchester has to say. And Richard, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I think on that, to expand a little bit on that point about the Keystone Pipeline, I think when Romney mentioned that in one of the debates, he may have even mentioned it more than once, that he was one of the things he was going to do on day one was to sign the pipeline going through. Obama had a perfect opportunity to respond to that in a negative way, and I think the fact that he did not is an indication that Obama as well, once reelected, would sign the pipeline bill and let it go through. But behind all that, I wish you would expand a little on the background of the oil and gas and fossil fuel industry and the extreme influence and impact that they're having on the national debate, number one, in support suppressing scientific knowledge and in distorting scientific knowledge and keeping it from the public? And number two, specifically, what kind of contributions are they making, both directly and through hidden PACs and think tanks, people like the Koch brothers exerting huge influence behind the scenes? What kind of impact are they having on the candidates through their contributions?
Those are good questions, Richard. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Brian, you want to take that?
Sure. Well, certainly the oil and gas industry, and I'd include coal as well, is making a big contribution to candidates in this election, and a lot of it mostly goes, although not entirely, to Republican candidates. Certainly a lot to Governor Romney. And it's interesting, you know, if you live in a battleground state, I know that Pennsylvania has been one, you're going to see a lot of ads about America's energy, domestic energy from clean coal, things like that. Sort of indicates these are industry groups that are really interested in blanketing the public with this message that natural gas is good, that coal keeps cities powered and so forth. I mean, certainly you have a lot more resources on that side of the issue than, say, on environmental groups or renewable energies. I don't think you're going to see a lot of big donations or a lot of big ads from the solar industry, for instance. So it's not even remotely close to a level playing field, and I think certainly some of the changes in campaign finance have only unbalanced that even further. And then if you go back, of course, the oil and gas industry has been involved in trying to spread doubt, I think, about climate science in recent years, a little bit less so, but certainly that's been something that historically has been the case, and they do stand to lose, I think, the most if we do look to take a much stronger position on climate change.
I'm looking at something you wrote for Ecocentric today having to do with Sandy and the fact that so much of the eastern seaboard is flooded. We've seen pictures that are actually quite horrifying. And one of the things that you say in there, Brian, is that part of our problem is we have moved so much of our country, or the country has moved so much to our coastlines that just puts them at risk. And we were talking earlier about the increase in sea level.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, even if you take away climate change from Sandy, and Sandy's sort of a very tricky storm to figure out in terms of what impact climate change is having on it, what we know is that climate change is increasing sea level, and we saw how devastating a coastal flood can be, not just to, you know, Atlantic City or seaside towns that are familiar with sort of the impact of the ocean coming over and getting them, but a city like New York that depends on infrastructure that's built close to sea level, or in the case of the subway, actually beneath the sea level, and we can see how devastating that is. It may take days, it may take weeks to get the subway system back going fully in New York City. We have no idea how long it'll take some power to get back, in part because transformers and other substations were actually flooded by these record-breaking storm surges. So it just underscores the need to prepare for this, not just in terms of definitely reducing carbon emissions, but how do we make a city like New York, how do we make a city like Philadelphia, other coastal cities, ready for higher sea levels and more powerful storms? That's something I think the presidential candidate should absolutely be talking about.
And the idea of some kind of a policy response to these threats of extreme weather.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there has to be a policy response in terms of dealing with extreme weather and climate change, but there also has to be a policy response saying, how do we make our society, how do we make our electrical grid, how do we make our infrastructure more resilient, more adaptable to a warmer world in the future?
But I also, have we moved past the kind of stark choice between, let's say, jobs in the economy and driving big cars and sitting in our cold houses wearing sweaters and, you know, eating tofu?
Well, I certainly think, you know, it's definitely not a one or the other choice, and no one is saying we need to ruin the United American economy in order to deal with climate change or deal with these other issues. You know, we can take smarter steps. We can make sure we're supporting renewable energy through subsidies and other aid. We can make sure we're actually spending a lot more on research to find out those really new sources of energy that will be able to compete with fossil fuels. We never spend enough on energy research. But also we need to think about local issues. I mean, how do we create a system of highway, transit, and so forth that is more resilient, that can bounce back faster? How do we create a grid that's smarter, that can respond and almost self-heal? You know, it's very interesting that the internet and cellular networks were able to sort of deal with Hurricane Sandy much better than the old electrical grid. The electrical grid is essentially a 20th century technology dealing with a 21st century world. There are new advances, a smarter grid that can be built, but that's going to cost money. I mean, that requires us to invest now to make sure that we reduce the chance of massive disasters like this in the future.
You have set us up perfectly for our second guest. And Brian Walsh, I want to thank you once again for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marnie.
You're welcome. Senior editor for Time International, writes the Going Green column for Time and Time.com, and he contributes to Time.com's environmental issues blog, and it's called Ecocentric. Well, we are talking about what hasn't been discussed on the campaign trail this year at the four debates, at numerous candidate interviews, the conventions, the rallies, and the ads that have littered the airwaves. And until Sandy slammed into the east coast of the U.S., there was no mention of infrastructure. And by that, I mean the aging and ailing bridges, railroad beds, roads, tunnels, energy grids that are so central to the country's economy and well-being. Joining us now is Robert Puentes, senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, where he directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And Robert Puentes, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks again for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, we are now talking about infrastructure, another neglected campaign issue. Any questions or comments that you might have about the issue and also about what the candidates have said about that issue, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Robert, it's interesting that a lot of candidates use infrastructure as a backdrop, but not much said about infrastructure itself on this campaign trail.
It's surprising for a couple of reasons. I mean, I think one is just that given the focus on the economy, right, that this is going to be something that is going to dominate the discourse during the campaign and is really going to sway voters' minds, that infrastructure is a big piece of that, you know, from private sector-driven investments in telecommunications and energy and pipelines, traditional investments, things like transportation, water, social infrastructure, you know, buildings, parks, all these kinds of things really is the backbone to the economy. And it seems odd to have a conversation about renewing the economy without talking about infrastructure.
Indeed, and infrastructure was always considered, or at least in my mind, a boring word, not that we haven't talked with you about it in the past, Robert, or certainly the least sexy word in the English language, infrastructure.
Yeah, until you know you see things like what's happened up in the Northeast this week, and you just see the primary role that infrastructure plays, not just in getting people around, but in communicating with one another, getting people to work, and keeping the economy humming. You know, it's one of those things that's it's missed until you don't have it, and then you really see the impact that it has when it's when it goes down.
And I know the American Society of Civil Engineers, I think others have done a kind of analysis of our infrastructure needs. What have they come up with? What are their findings?
When you look across the board, I mean, as a nation, we've really underinvested in infrastructure for a long time, not just in terms of rebuilding and maintaining the existing system, which is enormous. I mean, it's a big country, and some of this infrastructure is old, and it's reaching the end of its useful life, and it has to be maintained, it has to be modernized, it has to be reinvested in. All that comes with a price, but there's a lot of folks who are concerned that we don't even have the right kind of infrastructure to compete here in the global economy. There are some, you know, some clear ideas. With, you see, you know, modern airports in places, you see clean energy production in other countries. You know, a lot of things that we just don't have here in the U.S. So folks like the Society of Civil Engineers kind of count all that up and say that we've got numbers that are in the trillions of investment needs. And these numbers are almost so big they make your head spin. They say, well, there's nothing we can do about trillions of dollars of deficit here. But when you start picking them apart piece by piece and you look at the water system and you look at telecommunications and you look at pipelines, you start to take these one by one and start to sort out the roles and responsibilities, and what's, you know, what could be a private sector role, what could be, what does the federal government have to do, what can the states and metropolitan areas pick up, it starts to get a little bit more manageable.
But is it also that, as you said, trillions of dollars, which is, of course, an overwhelming number, is it that we don't have the money or we haven't had the money to invest in infrastructure repairs or even new infrastructure, or we have a bureaucracy that makes it hard to fix the system?
Well, we do. There is money that can be repurposed. I mean, there's, you know, it's not as easy as just moving from, you know, from one to another. But I don't think that that's our main problem. I think that we haven't really prioritized infrastructure in a lot of ways. We haven't really moved from systems that have funded the infrastructure for decades. What may have made sense in 1956 with President Eisenhower may not make sense anymore. We have to think of new ways to do that. And given that we're entering this, you know, this age of constraint, and these infrastructure price tags are so large, it's a tough conversation, I think, for these candidates to have.
How does the U.S. compare to other developed countries, and are they spending more money on their infrastructure?
In some ways, and I think they spend it differently, too. They make decisions out of funds on a national level. Some of them aren't federalist systems, so they don't have to deal with states and cities and metro areas in the same way. They make decisions on infrastructure investments through the general fund. In some ways, we've got other programs here that are firewalled, that are kind of dedicated trust funds for things like transportation infrastructure, aviation infrastructure, stuff like that. And you know, you can do things in places like China that you can't do here because of local land use and zoning and how all those different levels of government intersect. So it's tough to compare the U.S. to other countries broadly in infrastructure. I mean, things like freight rail here in the U.S. is absolutely state-of-the-art and the envy of the world over. You know, other things like high-speed rail, you see it in China, you see it in Spain, it's something we don't have here. So broadly, I think we're okay, but we definitely need to get much more focused, much more targeted, and connect infrastructure to the next American economy as opposed to just, you know, doing this hand-wringing and wishing that we had some of these big, bold investments.
So what would be top on your list? If we were to have a to-do list to deal with our infrastructure problems, what would that be?
We have to fix what's on the ground. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We just can't put these systems in place and just hope that they're going to last for years. They do need care and feeding, and they have to be maintained because people rely on them literally every single day, again, as we've seen this week. But again, as we're trying to push to a next economy that's, you know, that's more global, then we need to think about the infrastructure that's going to help us do things like doubling exports. So that would maybe lead you to some freight and port, seaport investments, airport investments, those kinds of things to connect U.S. metro areas with the global economy. As we're moving to more of a low-carbon economy, to take advantage of that big market, you know, that would lead you to other kinds of investments in green technology and clean energy and infrastructure, those kinds of things. As we're really focused on making sure that people are putting Americans to work, we have to make sure that they can actually still get to work. So investments in transit infrastructure and filling in gaps in the transportation network. So in other words, if you start with the economy as your end goal, and then you figure out what infrastructure investments we need to get to an economic goal, it's much clearer conversation than just saying, right, we've got a whole bunch of things out there, boy, I wish we had this. Infrastructure is not the way to start the conversation. It's the means to the economic end.
And about 45 seconds before our break here, Robert, but is this a public-private responsibility?
In some ways, not in all cases. There's some parts of the infrastructure network that have been private for a long time. Again, the freight rail network is the envy of the world over, and that's almost entirely a private-driven enterprise. Pipelines, telecommunications, you know, a lot of these things are private to begin with. Then you start to get into areas like, like toll roads or airports and other things that are more public-private, and then you've got other parts of infrastructure, social infrastructure, parks maybe, things like that are almost exclusively on the public side. So, again, infrastructure is a big thing. It includes a lot of different things. We definitely need to make sure that those partnerships, though, are taken advantage of when we can.
We are talking about some of the neglected issues this campaign season, talking with Robert Puentes about our infrastructure needs. He's a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What do you want a presidential candidate or a president to do about infrastructure? 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Tate Weller, Certified Public Accountant, celebrates 90 years of specialized audit, tax, and advisory services to national and global nonprofit and financial services clients. TAITWeller.com. Tate Weller. Focus, expertise, results.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Are you drinking more than you want to? Would you like to reduce your drinking? UPenn is conducting a 13-week research study of a medication to help people reduce their drinking. To participate, you must be 18 to 65 and a regular drinker. The study provides a medical evaluation, including blood tests, brief counseling, and monitoring of your drinking. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 241. 215-222-3200, extension 241. 7.45 miles. That's how long the course is for the 4th annual Y12K road race. Think you can handle it? Don't worry. There's also a relaxing 3K family walk run and the Y Kids Family Fit Zone. Sign up and hit the streets to support WHYY Saturday, November 10th. Runner or beginner, it's healthy fun for a good cause. Everyone's welcome. The course takes you from the Art Museum to Falls Bridge and back again. Visit whyy.org/y12k.
The Philadelphia Business Journal supports WHYY and is hosting the third annual Small Business Expo Delivering Happiness, December 11th at the PA Convention Center featuring Jen Lim of Zappos. PBJExpo.com or 215-238-5126.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. There have been 3 presidential debates, 1 vice presidential debate, interviews with candidates, 2 conventions, rallies, millions spent on political ads, and how much of that has been a discussion of infrastructure? Not much, which is why we called Robert Puentes to join us today on Radio Times. And we're talking, or I should say taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Robert, let me just ask you a couple of questions about President Obama and Governor Romney, where they have stood on this issue of infrastructure or stand today. Looking at the stimulus bill of a couple of years ago, it looks as if then, or I should say now, President Obama used a fair amount of that stimulus money for some of these infrastructure projects. Did they work out?
For the most part, yes. I mean, what the idea is, we kind of forget that we're really on this economic precipice, and the idea behind that stimulus money was to get the economy moving by getting money out there and putting people to work. When it comes to infrastructure, particularly the transportation money that was sent out, shovel ready kind of became a household word, because the idea was, well, you really can't go through a long planning exercise. You really can't, we got to get stuff done today. And so the idea was to figure out whatever was on the books, what was ready to go, give the money to those projects and have them go. And I think people were a little chagrined at the end, thought, well, we didn't get any kind of the things that during the campaign on both sides of the aisle, both Senator McCain and the president were talking about, a clean green recovery. We're talking about these new infrastructure investments, but if you're trying to do something quickly, you're not going to get that kind of stuff. And so we got, the pothole refillings, and you got the bridge repaintings, and the things that were ready to go, but you really didn't get that kind of new investment in new stuff, I think, that people might have been expecting.
Well, I know the president, a little bit more than a year ago, talked about the American Jobs Act, which looks like a bit of a continuation of the stimulus. Where does Governor Romney stand on investment in infrastructure?
Well, we haven't got that much. I mean, what we can look at is what he did when he was governor, and did quite a lot. I mean, there was some really interesting reforms that happened in Massachusetts during his tenure to make sure that that the state's investments in all kinds of different infrastructure were connected with other investments that the state was making for business development and land use and smart growth and all this kind of stuff. The idea was to make sure that these investments that are usually siloed are kind of connected to improve the state's economy, improve quality of life, and all that stuff. And so really amazing things that happened in the state during that time doesn't seem to be coming out much during the campaign. I mean, some of it's not a federal role responsibility, some of it is a state role, but it was good stuff, and I think it's things that should be talked about here. He's talked a little bit about, there's been stuff on cutting some of these subsidies towards clean energy firms, particularly wind and solar. Maybe some hints that he'd also cut some subsidies to fossil fuels firms and industries. I haven't really heard. Got a whole lot of clarification on that. But he has talked about public-private partnerships and more market mechanisms for funding infrastructure. I guess that means things like tolls, things like bonding mechanisms that can be paid back through some kind of revenue stream from the user. And again, tolls are top of the list maybe of that, electric utilities, things like that.
How about high-speed rail? Where do the candidates stand on that?
That's a good question. There's not a whole lot on that. That was a big part of the stimulus package. Was the one thing that really wasn't shovel ready. That kind of went through a whole different exercise where that money wasn't sent out right away. It was held back, and then states had to apply for the money, and then the federal government sent it out based on the merits of the applications. And then it got all kind of confused with the governor's races that were going on, and governors sending money back even though the states had applied for it. So you kind of got into a different rigmarole around high-speed rail that I think confused the conversation so much that it's not really talked about much during the campaign.
You think it should be? I mean, is that something we should, as you said, this is a big country, but there are parts of this country where people really live pretty close together.
Yeah, and it's there are places where I think you can make these investments, whether it's just modifications to the existing Amtrak system, maybe higher speed rail, maybe fixing some of the bottlenecks in the system. But I think reorienting people so they're not conceiving of this as Japanese bullet trains are going to be shooshing around the United States anytime soon, especially given that we're really living in this age of constraint now. These are really expensive investments, and it's going to have to be iterative. And these iterative improvements to Amtrak are probably not great campaign fodder.
And iterative meaning kind of incremental?
Yeah, and fixing bottlenecks here and there, technological improvements, you know, minor augmentations that are get you from 75 miles an hour to 85 miles an hour, you know, those kinds of improvements. You're not going to get to 300 miles an hour anytime soon. So it's tough, I think, to show that that's the kind of investment that we're looking for now.
Well, we are talking about what hasn't been talked about on the campaign trail. Robert Puente is our guest. He directs the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And yes, we are talking about infrastructure, and that means bridges and roads and railroad grids and subways and electrical grids and all the stuff that we rely on. And the question is why it hasn't been talked about much on the campaign trail and why it's important. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let's get Brian from Stockton to join us. And Brian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm wondering what you think about the role of states. We hear about the role of state versus federal government in other areas, but with infrastructure, are you seeing that 50 different procurement systems and 50 different states that have to get up to speed on the latest innovation is a barrier to overall better performance? And do you think that the United States, to be competitive in the world, might be better off federalizing some of these these infrastructure investments so that we can get over governors fighting on ideological grounds, high-speed rail? I'm just wondering what you think about the role of state versus federal when the stakes are so high, it seems, for global competitiveness.
Brian, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Robert, you want to take that?
It's a terrific question, and I think it has actually it's responsible for a lot of the confusion we have about infrastructure now. As the caller said, I mean, we're going through a larger conversation in this country with the campaign, with Congress, with folks here in Washington about, you know, what the federal government should be doing. It came up in the FEMA conversations this week. You know, what is the appropriate role for the federal government? I think that we need to get to a point where the federal government is focused on those things that the federal government has to be present in, given the size and scope of some of these issues. Things like the Global Aviation Network, right, are global in scale. It's not something the state's going to be able to deal with by themselves. Intercity kind of movement of passengers is another thing. Transmission lines that cut from, you know, places where the wind is being generated in the Midwest, you know, to the southeast part of Virginia, cuts through a whole bunch of states. The federal government's got to be present and responsible there. Ports, you know, seaports, those kinds of things. There's large issues that are national in scope where we need to have a federal government that's present and responsible and an effective partner. But then again, I think there's a lot of other areas that I think where the caller was going that can be devolved to the states. We don't need to have the federal government involved in all kinds of small decisions that may be more local in scope. And I think as we go through this next couple of years, this period where it's a little bit of churning here in Washington, some of that stuff is going to sort itself out. But it's a great question.
Indeed it is. Let me see what Jeff from Newtown has to say. And Jeff, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my phone call.
You're very welcome.
My question centers on Amtrak. What is each candidate's position regarding continued federal funding of Amtrak, and what do you believe their view is, respectively, of Amtrak as a national solution to a rail travel network in this country?
Another good question, Jeff. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Robert, go ahead.
Amtrak has been much maligned over the years. I think that we haven't seen that much about it. I think that it's been a punching bag from some folks, even still now in Congress. This is still going on. I think that if the Romney administration is looking for across-the-board cuts, I think Amtrak may be one of those things that's kind of in their sights. The administration has been generally supportive of it, but there was legislation that was passed a few years ago that really changes almost everything about Amtrak and making sure that it's much more of a federal, state, even local partnership. And it's not just some kind of big, bloated federal program where they're shoving money in places where it doesn't belong. In fact, this legislation really puts the states on the hook for supporting a lot of these routes. If it's going through your state, if you want it to be there, then you got to bring some money and you got to bring some responsibility to the table. And we're seeing some of these systems in places like North Carolina and places like Maine, where the state does have a larger role. These are some of the best routes in the country. So I think, again, we're going to see some of this sorting out of the role of the federal government, and it's going to play itself out with Amtrak very directly over the next bunch of years.
Jeff, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I think also, Robert, the fact that Vice President Biden has been taking Amtrak for years probably makes it secure under a second Obama administration.
Yeah, in the Northeast Corridor, I mean, there's more passengers that take the train between Washington and New York than fly. It is very efficient. It is very effective. It does work quite well. It serves the business communities, particularly in those two metropolitan areas, quite well, and everything in between, Philly and Baltimore. So I think that the idea is not to dismantle the entire system, but again, to have it focused and to make minor tweaks where we can.
You mentioned the electrical grid, and I'm thinking of all those pictures of the last couple of days of, you know, toppled telephone poles that have brought down the electrical grid and people's ability to communicate and turn their lights on. Does it make sense, looking ahead, to bury all our power lines?
It makes sense. There's no doubt about it. Every time here in the Washington region too, every time that there's a storm of the summer, it's, you know, that's kind of the target, and we all kind of wonder, well, why aren't these things underground? And it's, you know, it's expensive. That's really the primary reason. Taking all this above ground infrastructure and putting it below ground, it's got big regulatory hurdles, and it's got big institutional hurdles, and it's got big financial hurdles. You know, if this keeps happening, maybe that'll spur some action, but I think the costs and the regulatory hurdles are the big barriers right now.
Well, you mentioned money, and obviously any kind of major investment in infrastructure, even if it's a public-private partnership, is going to increase government spending. And so much of the focus has been on too much government spending and the fact that we have this multi-trillion dollar debt. Is there another way to kind of think about this kind of investment?
Just on the electrical piece?
Or even just sort of broadly speaking, but certainly on the electrical piece.
Well, broadly, sure. I mean, there's lots of different proposals. I think that given the understanding, I think, outside of Washington, that the federal government's going to be, you know, operating under some constraints in a few years, that all of this innovation that has been happening out in states and metros with public-private partnerships, with new ways of raising money, referenda, going to the voters, having them approve mostly sales tax referenda to pay for infrastructure investments, innovative loan programs, things that the city of Los Angeles is starting to pioneer, and reorienting this partnership between the federal government and the states is starting to become much more the norm than the exception. Whereas before, we were finding interesting best practices where places were doing things that were maybe interesting. We need to pay attention to. They seem there's so much innovation that's happening in states and metros that I think that's where we're going to see some of these new things happening. We have the infrastructure bank idea, which didn't get much traction and is still struggling here in Washington. You know, the mayor of Chicago is planning to do it. They've been talking about this in state of Virginia and state of New York. So, again, you know, states and metros, laboratories of democracy, it's going to happen that way in infrastructure, too.
Well, let me see what Rob from Wallingford has to say. Rob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I've been really disappointed that people have not made the observation that the infrastructure spending really does not contribute to the deficit in the long term, because you're creating real assets. And Congressman Cantor and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce endorsed infrastructure projects early, and then it disappeared. People just didn't explain this, should be doing it repeatedly.
Well, I'm glad you did, Rob, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Robert Puentes, you want to add to that?
No, I couldn't make the point any better. I mean, we talk about things like these big investments we need for things like take a seawall barrier in New York Harbor to prevent Manhattan from getting flooded. Right. Yeah, it's a big investment up front. Was it, you know, maybe $10 billion, make up a number, $15 billion, but it's going to save, you know, billions of dollars if you have these catastrophes in the future. So taking this long-term view of infrastructure has been really tough for people, which is why I think making sure that it's directly connected to the economy is the way to go. We see what happens when you connect it to the short term around job creation. Again, you need to do that. Infrastructure has a big role to play in putting people back to work in more jobs and in better jobs. But we need to make sure that it's also putting us on the path to a more sustainable economy for the future that's global in scope and that takes advantage of just of a new direction for the United States, more productive-oriented as opposed to consumption-oriented, which is what predated the recession.
And Rob, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Robert, we're almost out of time here, but picking up on your vision of long-term investments, but we have these short-term election cycles, and, you know, every 2 or 4 years, and now elections are 24/7, 365 days a year. It's as if our political system is so focused on the short term, we can't think of the long term.
Yeah, I think that's in Washington. I think you're certainly true. But when we leave the Beltway and you see what's happening with governor's races, you see what's happening with mayor's races, state legislatures, they do talk about this in a very, very different way. And I think it's because it's much more tangible.
Right.
In some ways, it's more specific. They're talking specifically about an investment in this place, you know, for this kind of investment. Here's how we're going to pay for it. Here's how it's going to end. You know, it's a very different conversation. I think that where Washington may have been out in front of the states and metros for a few years on infrastructure, I think it's completely flipped the other way. And we're going to see states and metros, cities taking over. The innovations happening from there, hopefully, we're down to the benefit of Washington somewhere down the pipe.
Well, Robert Puente, is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It was a great question.
Thanks so much. And he's senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. He directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. The second of two guests in this hour of Radio Times, we began with Brian Walsh, who writes for Time International. We are talking today on Radio Times about things that haven't been talked about on the campaign trail. And we have two more issues waiting in the wings. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, though. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.